So back to Matthew 10. We're looking at the disciples. Here in this chapter, we read about how Jesus chose 12 of his disciples and gave them a special, unique position. He gave them special authority, which he didn't give to anyone else. He called them his apostles, his messengers, his representatives. And then he sent them out to work for him. He told them that they must go out as his messengers. They must travel all over the land of Israel. They must preach in every town and village. But before they left, he gave them a detailed briefing. He prepared them for their mission. And that's what we've got in verses 5 to 42 of this chapter. We've got the briefing that Jesus gave to the 12 when he sent them out. Here we can read the marching orders that they were given. And I said that we would be looking at the chapter under four headings. And the first was this. We've got the instructions that Jesus gives to these men. The instructions that Jesus gives to these men. And that's verses 5 to 15. In verses 5 to 15, Jesus gives his disciples a set of detailed instructions about the work they've been sent to do and how they're to go about that work. He tells them where to go. He tells them what message they're to preach. He tells them what to do alongside the preaching. He tells them what they should charge for their services. He tells them what to take with them. You'll find all those things in verses 5 to 10. And we thought about those things already. And then he tells them something further. He tells them where they're to stay. Verse 11. Whatever town or village you enter, search for some worthy person there and stay at his house until you leave. If the home, as you enter the home, give it your greeting. If the home is deserving, let your peace rest on it. If it's not, let your peace return to you. As they travel around in every town or village, they are to look for someone who's willing to put them up in his home. Now that was a very natural thing in that culture. It was a much more hospitable culture than ours is. People were much more ready to give hospitality to complete strangers. If a traveller turned up on your doorstep, it was only courteous to offer him a meal, if necessary to give him a bed for the night. That was expected. There are still many parts of the world where it's like that. I remember when I was in northern Cyprus, I'd gone out on a push bike to explore a bit, and I found I had a slow puncture, and bit by bit the tyre went completely flat. I was 10 or 15 miles from base. There was no pump on the bike. So I stopped at the garage. Well, they had no pump. So I stopped at the next house along the road. And oh yes, they did have a pump. But I wasn't allowed to use it. Oh no, I was made to sit down on a rug while the householder pumped away madly. And the ladies of the house all gathered around me to give me a cold drinks and to feed me with refreshments. I've no doubt at all that if I had said, well, can I stay here tonight? They'd have said, well, of course. They'd have felt ashamed not to say that. That was expected in that culture. And it was expected in Bible times. Well, here then are the disciples. They arrive in a town. They need somewhere to stay. So they're going to knock on somebody's door and ask, can we stay here? Well, who should they stay with? Should they make their way to the home of the richest man in town? Should they knock on his door and ask for hospitality? Or should they go to the leader of the synagogue or the local mayor? Who should they try to get on side? Someone who's influential? Someone who's rich? Someone who's strategic in some way? No, says Jesus. Search out someone who is worthy. Search for some worthy person. Remember, he says to the disciples, you've got a great blessing to bring. You are royal messengers. Whichever home you stay in, you are doing that home a great honour. Well, make sure that it's a home that's worthy of that honour. You're not asking for a favour, you're giving a favour. You're bringing peace into that home. You're bringing the blessings of God's kingdom into that home. So look for someone who's worthy to receive that honour. Someone who deserves the privilege of having the messengers of the Messiah in their home. And that may not necessarily be the wealthiest person in town or the most reputable person in town. It may be an elderly widow who spent her life praying for God's kingdom to come. It may be a godly working man who doesn't have much money but who honours God by doing a decent day's work for a day's wage. Go to that home, says Jesus, and stay there until you leave. Do you see why he adds that? Stay there until you leave. It may be that while you're there in that home, someone else will approach you and suggest that you move over to their home. Somebody who thinks he's in a position to do you a favour. Stay where you are, says Jesus. Don't shop around looking for the most prestigious place to stay, the room with the best view. Your agenda isn't to make yourself as comfortable as you can. It's to bring the blessing of God. It's to bring the peace of God to those who are ready for it. As you enter the home, says Jesus, give it your blessing. They would use the usual blessing. Shalom, shalom. Peace, peace to this home. Of course, when most people use that blessing, it didn't really mean very much. It was just like us saying good morning even when it's teeming with rain. But the disciples of Jesus really do bring peace into the home where they stay. They're calling down God's peace, God's favour upon that home. And Jesus says it. If the home is deserving, it's the same word as worthy in verse 11. If the home is worthy, let your peace rest on it. Or really, I think it should be, may your peace rest on it. If this home is indeed a worthy home, the home of people who are serious about seeking God, honouring God, then Jesus says, may your peace rest upon it. The prayer that the disciples pray for that home will be effective because Jesus himself underwrites it. He calls down peace on that home. May peace rest on it, says Jesus. And if it's not a worthy home, says Jesus, then may your peace return to you. Though the home will find no blessing, you'll find that you yourselves will be blessed as you pray for it. So those are Jesus' instructions about where his disciples are to stay. Can we draw any lessons from any of this? After all, we are living in a very different culture. And most of us aren't travelling from place to place preaching the gospel. And if we were, well, mostly we can arrange accommodation in advance. I mean, the passage might be directly relevant for missionaries working in some unevangelized areas of the world, travelling among the Rendille or the Pokot. But what does the passage have for us? I think more than anything, the passage helps me to adjust my mindset. It's terribly easy for us to slide into a feeling that we almost need to apologize for being Christians and for coming to people with the gospel. We start to feel that they are doing us a great favor if they allow us any time, or if they give us any opportunity. And Jesus tells us that it's not so, that it is exactly the other way round. If we go, let's say, into a nursing home, and we take a service in that nursing home, that's not the nursing home doing us a favor. We're going into that nursing home as ambassadors of the King. We're offering the King's peace to the people who live in that place. We're calling down God's peace upon that home. Whether they realize it or not, that nursing home is being given a huge privilege, a huge honor. And we need to feel that we are bringing them a huge honor. If we invite a neighbor along to a service, then remember, we are inviting them to share in the most special, the most privileged gathering in the world. We're doing them a huge honor. You know, when the Queen sends out invitations to one of her garden parties, I'm sure she doesn't sit there thinking, oh, do I dare do this? I mean, it'd be impertinent of me, isn't it, to approach these different people and invite them along. I mean, I'm asking an awfully big favour of these people to ask them to travel to London to one of my parties. I'm sure that the Queen is conscious that she's bestowing a great honour upon them by giving them the invitation. I'm sure her letter will be very courteous in tone. Her Majesty requests the honour of your attendance, or whatever the wording may be. Strangely, I've never had one of those letters. Well, when we invite people to a service, we're giving them a far more valuable, a far richer honour. If they accept the invitation, then they're going to be stepping into a company of people where God is actually present in a way that he's present nowhere else. They're going to be stepping into the place where God is speaking and listening and moving among his people and doing extraordinary and glorious things. We have to think of all our gospel work in that way. The people of the world may think that they're doing us favours by giving us an opening to speak. But it's not that way. Remember how Jesus compared us with messengers sent out to summon people to a magnificent banquet. You know that parable? And surely one of the things then that parable tells us is that to go to people in the name of Christ is to do those people the greatest kindness, the greatest favour, the greatest honour you can do them. Imagine inviting them to sit down at the banquet of the King of Kings. We don't have to apologise for giving them an invitation. We don't have to feel, oh, well, I mean, this is something a bit impertinent of me. And another of the key things that you realize when you read that parable is that those silly people who refused the invitation for such trivial reasons, the only people they were hurting were themselves. They were being offered a wonderful opportunity and they threw it away. The disciples here aren't to go out into the world with a cringing, apologetic attitude. Oh, we'll be so lucky if anybody takes us in. It's an awful lot to ask of anyone. No, says Jesus to them, go boldly. You decide which home in the town is the home that best deserves your presence. And as you walk into that home, be conscious that you are bestowing a blessing, not taking one. You're only asking food and drink from them. But you're the channel by which all the blessings of God, the peace of God, may come to them. And if they refuse to have you, then who's the loser? You? No, it's they who are depriving themselves of the greatest blessing in the world. He's encouraging his disciples to go with a sense of boldness. Which brings us then to Jesus' words in verses 14 and 15. Jesus has told them where to stay. And he's assured them that there will be people who will receive them. But he's also made it plain that there are some people who won't receive them. There will be some homes that are not worthy of their presence. Now he tells them how to react when they're rejected, when they're turned away. He makes it plain that there will be situations where they will meet with a flat rejection. If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake the dust off your feet when you leave that home or town. That's how they're to react when they're rejected or turned away. Shake the dust off your feet when you leave that home or town. If a home welcomes you, says Jesus, call down God's peace upon it. And if a home or a whole town rejects you, if they refuse to listen to your preaching, then shake the dust off your feet when you leave that town. Now, Jesus' disciples would know what that meant. Imagine a Jew who's been traveling in Gentile countries. And finally, he arrives back at the land of Israel. And as he crosses the border from Gentile territory into Jewish territory, he shakes the dust from those Gentile countries off his shoes. Doesn't want to carry that unholy dust into the Holy Land. That was common practice for faithful Jews coming from the accursed Gentile world into the Holy Land. They would shake the dust off their feet. Well, says Jesus to his disciples, you must do the same thing when you leave a Jewish town that's refused to listen to the gospel. You do just the same thing as a sign that that town is now on a par with any Gentile town. Remember, Israel was supposed to be the Holy Land. It was supposed to be God's land. And every town in Israel was supposed to be under God's protection in a special way. But a town that rejects these messengers has got no right to think of itself as being holy at all. It's not under any special protection from God any longer. Jesus says to his disciples, when that town rejects you, when it rejects the gospel, it loses all its privileges. It loses all its claim to God's kindness. It loses God's protection immediately. From that moment on, it's just like a Gentile city. It's like Babylon or Rome, or for that matter, it's like Sodom or Gomorrah. That's what Jesus says in verse 15. I tell you the truth, it will be more bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. For Jewish people, Sodom and Gomorrah were the supreme example of how wicked Gentile cities could be. Towns that needed to be wiped off the face of the earth. The final proof of the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah was when God sent angels as messengers to Sodom and Gomorrah. And they were rejected and threatened. Well, Jewish towns which reject Jesus' messengers, as far as God is concerned, are worse than Sodom or Gomorrah. At the day of judgment, they'll be dealt with in a more terrible way than Sodom and Gomorrah were dealt with. That's what Jesus is telling his disciples here. Now notice, Christians often read more into these verses than the verses say. I've often heard these verses quoted to prove that there comes a point where you shouldn't preach to certain people anymore, or where you shouldn't try to evangelize certain places anymore, that you should just abandon them to face judgment. Shake the dust off your feet against them. People think that means have nothing more to do with them. Well, that may or may not be true, but there's nothing about that in these verses. All the disciples are told is that when they have preached in a particular town and that town has refused to listen, that when they move on, they must declare that that town has lost any claim to God's favor. They must declare that that town is exposed to God's judgment. But Jesus doesn't say that they must never go back to that town. He doesn't say that they must never preach to those people again or urge them to repent. He simply says that from now on, in God's eyes, that town is like any Gentile town. And that's the way the disciples must think of it. In other words, that town is moved into the category where all our towns in this country are to begin with. We are a Gentile country. We start in our outreach where the disciples left off. When the disciples arrived in a town in Israel, they could say, well, this town is in the Holy Land. At the moment, it has a special place under God's protection. But if the town rejected their preaching, then they had to say, that's no longer true now. This is now a town under judgment. But all our towns are towns under judgment. None of our towns have had any special promise of protection from God. We start from the fact that our towns are unclean places, unholy places, that they rest on unclean soil, that they're places on which God's wrath rests. Our calling is to preach in Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, sometimes we hear very confused language from Christians. They talk about this as a Christian country and the importance of keeping it as a Christian country, as if this were a holy land, a land that belonged to God in a special way. But no, there has only ever been one holy land in this world, and that was the land of Israel. And that ceased to be a holy land when the towns and villages of that land rejected the Messiah. It then became like any Gentile land. The equivalent of the holy land today, if you're looking for one, is the church. It's the church that God has set apart for himself. It's within the church that God dwells. And when I talk about the church, I mean the community of all those who are truly saved, those who are indwelt by the Spirit. When you are within the church, yes, you're standing then on holy ground. But apart from the church, this whole world is Gentile territory. This world in its entirety is a world where horrible idols are worshipped, where the messengers of Jesus are rejected. This whole world lies under the wrath of God. And this whole world in the end will be like Sodom and Gomorrah, handed over to eternal fire. And we've got to be so conscious of that as we live and work in this world. We're not like the disciples at this point in their lives, on a whirlwind tour, visiting a town for a few days or weeks, maybe facing rejection, but then knocking off the dust and moving on. We have to live in towns that are under judgment, and we have to live in them all our lives. We have to live in a world that's unclean, that's facing wrath. So all the time we have to be guarding our own souls so carefully. We don't have the option of just knocking the unclean dust off our feet and moving on into some clean, holy environment, hiding away in a monastery. We're living, we're Lot lived. We're living in Sodom and Gomorrah. And yet we've got to make sure that the corruption that filled the whole atmosphere of that city doesn't infect us. We have to make sure that we stay pure in an impure setting. And we have to look at our neighbours and our friends and the people we work with. And we have to remember that already wrath is hanging over every one of them. It's not that when finally we have evangelized this area as thoroughly as we want to and feel that we've been rejected, then wrath will come. They're already under wrath. So we're not just saying to people, peace be unto you. We're also saying, flee from the wrath to come. There's got to be a note of urgency and crisis in our witness. We're living in Sodom and Gomorrah in the last few minutes before the fire falls, before the earthquake of judgment tears the world apart. Already the rumblings of the great earthquake are sounding around us. So we can't think of gospel work as a leisurely, low-key, chat along, user-friendly, keep everyone happy sort of activity. You know, for those disciples, it must have been an awesome thing, a scary thing to do, to shake the dust off their feet. And to know that a town had been condemned to destruction, if they ever did go back to that town. They can't have gone back then with a sort of jolly, smiley, we'll run a few sort of entertainments and slip in a few gospel words somewhere in the process. They must have gone then with a terrible urgency, because they know they're going to a town that's already doomed. But that's where all our cities are. That's where all our towns are. That's where Cheadle Heath is. That's Stockport. The wrath of God is hanging over this town today. Do you see again why I emphasize so strongly in earlier studies on Matthew 10 that we're not standing in the same situation as the disciples? Jesus' instruction to us is not shake off the dust of Stockport or Manchester and hand it over to judgment. Jesus' command to us is live in Stockport or Manchester with the awareness that it's already a city under judgment. And plead with every individual who's willing to listen, flee from the wrath to come. I wish I could make every one of you here, those of you who are already Christians, and those of you who aren't, I wish I could get you to see our town, our society, for what it is. A community over which the fearful anger of God is brooding every moment. Sodom and Gomorrah. Think for a moment about those cities. Think for a moment about the people of Sodom and Gomorrah going about their business from day to day. They had shops in Sodom and Gomorrah. People went to the shops and they bought food and they took food back to their homes. And they ate and they drank. And people in Sodom and Gomorrah had their sports. And they had their hobbies. And they had their games. People in Sodom and Gomorrah entertained themselves. And had social gatherings. And it may be that people in Sodom and Gomorrah had some sort of religion, some sort of worship as well. They were people like us, people like your neighbours, people like your friends who lived in Sodom and Gomorrah. But they were people who lived without God. And God sent messengers to them. God sent angels to Sodom and Gomorrah. Instead of blessing God for his mercy, they despised those messengers and they abused them. They would have done horrible, wicked things to them if God had allowed it. And God said, enough. And there came a day when the earth began to tremble under the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And there came a day when the skies above those cities became dark. Came a day when a great cloud overshadowed those cities. And then the fire of God fell from heaven. And the burning sulfur began to be sweep across the city, carried by the gales of God's anger. And the people began to scream. It was too late. Cities were buried. Go to the Dead Sea now and see how totally God obliterated those cities. Do you believe in the God of wrath? Jesus says, Sodom and Gomorrah, it will be more bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for towns, for people who reject the gospel of Jesus Christ. Some of you here, God has sent you so many messengers. The first messengers he sent you were your own parents. Most of the children in this area weren't sent Christian parents to warn them, but you were. Then God sent you Sunday school teachers. Then he sent you camp leaders. Then he sent you preachers, myself and many other preachers who have stood here. And they've all said the same thing to you: flee from the wrath to come. They've all warned you that there's going to come a day when God's wrath is going to break. And they've all said to you, Jesus Christ is the only one who can protect you when the wrath of God breaks. And they've said he's willing to. They've said the arms of Jesus are wide open to hug you, to hold you tight to himself where you'll be safe. And you haven't fled from the wrath to come. When the disciples went to any of these towns, they could do one of two things. They could bring peace upon a person, upon a home, upon a town. Or they could pronounce the wrath of God upon it. You can have peace with God. You can, even here in this world, there can be a lovely, happy, sweet friendship between you and God. And you can have God with you every day of your life. And one day you can dwell in a world where there is nothing but peace. You can have that, or you can live still in this world and the wrath of God will fall on you. Isn't it time just to get down on your knees and to plead with God to save you? Isn't it time to say to the Lord Jesus, Lord Jesus, I need you. I can't save myself, but you can save me. Please, please save me. Isn't it time for you to call out to him? May God take up the things we've said in this place this morning and apply them to our hearts.